her one. Back to the Lopez family, whose puffy taco empire continues to thrive. Ray Lopez, who passed away in 1988, sold Ray's drive-in to Arturo in 1982 for an undisclosed amount of cash, a car, and a promise that it would continue to operate under its original name. It looks much like it did when Ray owned it. The decor is eclectic and time-worn, with paintings and license plates on the walls. In the middle of the dining room, there's an awe-inspiring altar replete with religious candles, fading photographs, and statues of saints, as well as La Virgen de Guadalupe smack dab in the middle. Customers are allowed to leave a nickel, a dime, any amount to light a candle, as much as Catholics do in church. The money collected is given to San Juan de los Lagos Parish and Shrine around the corner from the restaurant. Lopez Rambo says that even today, the occasional prayer circle is held in front of the altar. The back room at Ray's has more in common with the roadside curio shop than a dining room, crammed with bric-a-brac such as taxidermied wildcat, a saddle, and black-and-white photos, as well as painted portrait of the Lopez brothers. There's also a 1926 Ford Model T truck, one of the many classic rides in Ray's collection. Upstairs is the restaurant's office and the apartment that Arturo used when he visited from California. He had a little bachelor pad there, Lopez Rambo says. He had a jacuzzi in there, a big living room. It was beautiful, a beautiful apartment. I know my mom loved it, too. For decades, Arturo continued to go back and forth between California and Texas. When his health began to decline, he and Gloria closed the La Habra and West Covina outpost of Arturo's and returned to San Antonio, leaving the Whittier location in the hands of Maria's older brother, John Lewis, who still runs it today. When Arturo passed away at the age of 77, ownership of Arturo's and Ray's passed into a trust overseen by his widow, Gloria, and her children. Maria splits her time between San Antonio and California. Three generations after Maria Rodriguez Lopez accidentally invented the puffy taco, the family remains bound up with her creation. The old Lopez family home is within walking distance of Ray's, and the family owns three houses behind the restaurant, which they use when they are in town. Behind the driveway gate, next to the restaurant's spillover gravel parking lot, there are more classic cars from Ray's collection, including a 1928 Falcon Knight, a 1953 Chevrolet pickup, and a 1954 Corvette convertible. Reminders that Ray's has a drive-in option. Flashing your lights and the server will run out to your car. Although slight changes have been made over the years, the once cash-only restaurant now accepts credit and debit cards, its puffies are still heavenly. If they were any lighter, they would flit away into the firmament. With long wait times for a table, even at lunch, Ray's seems more popular than ever. The same is true of Henry's Puffy Tacos, although as a company, the restaurant has done more to leverage its brand. The original Henry's Puffy Tacos location on West Woodlawn Avenue, a squat counter service establishment, was renamed Henry's Puffy Tacos Express after a Henry's Puffy Tacos Cantina opened on Bandera Road. Henry's produces a tortilla with a crispy, just shy of flaky exterior. The chewy center, which in concert with the ground beef, lettuce, tomato, and cheese, cools and heats, giving the palate crunch, salt, and a touch of sweetness from the tomato. It's a masterpiece. Henry's marquee menu item is the inspiration for the San Antonio Missions, Henry the Puffy Taco mascot, created in 1989 by Henry's Puffy Tacos CEO, Jaime Lopez. Yes. On May 22nd, the Puffy Taco will achieve a milestone of sorts when the Missions declare that day National Puffy Taco Day and change their name to the Puffy Tacos for the weekend's three-home game stretch. The players will don field regulation caps with the logo of Henry the Puffy Taco holding a bat and wear jerseys emblazoned with photorealistic renderings of various taco fillings. Puffy Tacos have already received the imprimatur of the White House and a high-end Dallas chef. Now that they've been fully embraced by America's pastime, you have to wonder, when will the rest of the country catch on? This was used with permission from the University of Texas Press, copyright 2020. And since we're on the subject of food, we'll turn now to the state. This is Food and Drink, and it's Pat's Pick. It's by Patricia Sharp, called Playing with Fire. At Chef Kevin Fink's new Austin restaurant, Hestia, the menu is a work of art. The first thing you see are the logs, a 12-foot-tall bank of them, stacked snugly in a recess by the host stand. If this were a barbecue joint, nobody would think twice. But Hestia is not a smokehouse. It is Austin's restaurant of the moment, a sleek venue amid the forest of skyscrapers that is rendering the west side of downtown unrecognizable. The restaurant's design is edgy and modern, with rough concrete beams and exposed ductwork lending the necessary note of industrial chic. In the 84-seat dining area, booths of chocolate brown leather face floor-to-ceiling plate glass windows framing views of massive buildings and winsome little trees. More to the point, Hestia is the domain of two of the city's most innovative cooking talents. Executive chef Kevin Fink, who made the James Beard Award finals last year, and pastry chef and business partner Caval Bristol Joseph. Boston diners fell hard for their work at Timmer and Rye. That restaurant, which opened in 2015, tapped into the national obsession with sustainable local foods. It revels in heirloom grains, pickled and preserved vegetables, and whole animal butchery, worthy principles that have been incorporated into Hestia's menu as well. There's just one major addition: those logs. Almost all the cooking is done over shimmering flames and glowing embers. Live fire, as you are no doubt aware, is a thing these days, as are restaurants with open hearths. If you've been to Husk in Nashville or Royster in Chicago, you know the trend. Fink has been intrigued with the idea for several years, but he didn't want to do anything reflexively, so he and Bristol Joseph did some field work, traveling as far away as Japan. Then he convened the Emmer and Rye staff in a lakeside cabin to brainstorm. "We spent days sharing ideas," he told me. "We asked, would we cook only over a hot fire, a slow fire? Can we go deeper? Can we also be inspired by wood and ash?" The result of all that effort, and the centerpiece of Hestia, is a 20-foot hearth miraculously shoehorned into the open kitchen. Doesn't look like something from Game of Thrones, though. Instead, it's modern and mostly stainless steel, divided into units for baking, grilling, and more. There's even a tandoor. In each cooking area, post-oak logs crackle away, flames licking upward as the wood changes from brown to gray to white. Once you've gotten a good look at the kitchen, it's time to settle down and order something to drink, perhaps a little birdie, an agreeable concoction of vodka, honey, hibiscus, lavender, and lemon. Because you don't want your feathered friends to be lonesome, adding one of the amuse-bouche-sized snacks makes sense. Toast with Wagyu beef belly lardo would be my recommendation, if only for a sample of the fantastic sourdough bread made from the restaurant's own starter. A cloud of baked bubbles could not be lighter. There are also lovely Atlantic oysters on the shell, brightened with nubbins of tart, lightly smoked tomato, and dabs of jalapeno-tinged chive oil. Crudos, the next section of the menu, is short, but this is where Fink really hits his stride, doing highly original riffs on traditional preparation. The snapper crudo, for instance, comes accessorized with a jet-black sauce called a Ricado Negro, Swedish, just this side of burnt, which uses jalapenos smoked on the hearth, as well as garlic, beets, and orange zest. The pieces of fish are outfitted with wrappers of mustard greens and are cut into precise discs. A colorful garnish of red-rimmed radish and bright orange carrot finishes the pretty arrangement. When it comes to small plates, the choices are more extensive. The nibbles of king crab are divine, a swim with sourdough croutons and smoked butter, which gets a tart splash of wild black persimmon vinegar and a hit of umami from roasted kelp. And under no circumstances should you miss the Parker House rolls with cultured butter. A little sidebar here real quick. Burning love. In Greek mythology, Hestia was the name of the goddess of hearth and home. Fire that burned on every house and temple's central hearth was thus considered sacred. Her sacrificial animal of choice, the domestic pig. Next, so moving on to entrees, you get options and more options. Meat and fish cookery gives the live fire method a workout. My friend's dry-aged Wagyu Angus skirt steak came off astonishingly tender, sided by a novel sauce of tomato, vinegar, and fermented eels. My gorgeous snowy white halibut fillet was another story, though. Slow cooked in a mesh strainer high over the heat, it was a lovely piece of fish, but the soft, almost gauzy texture took some getting used to. for something utterly original, the shaggy, amazing smoked and grilled lion's mane mushrooms are brushed with, among other things, a savory black bean miso that has been barrel aging for a year and a half, with Fink fussing over it like an anxious father. And speaking of Fink, the chefs often bring out the dishes to explain them. Doesn't always work with the noise level, but I appreciate the effort. By the end of the meal, you're maybe flagging, but you must try one of Bristol Joseph's beauty pageant caliber desserts. The frothy, deconstructed New York cheesecake is quite the crowd pleaser, and the s'mores is adorable. But the one not to skip is the traditional Japanese kakigori, a softball-sized mound of frozen deliciousness, so outrageous and photogenic that there are Instagram accounts dedicated to it. Bristol Joseph uses silky shaved ice, roasted white chocolate, honey ice cream, and a dusting of matcha powder. Long after the server brought the check, I sat there at the table, scooping up one more chili spoonful after another. It was a better way to end a meal where almost everything was cooked with flames. I couldn't imagine what it would be. Kind of makes me hungry. All right. We're turning now to one of the this is the one of the feature articles, and we'll do this because a lot of the public events recently have been canceled or postponed due to the issues with the coronavirus. And so what this is, it was a story done about some of the musicians that were scheduled to play at South by Southwest this year in Austin, but were unable to because that festival was canceled. So none of those folks would get to do their live sets or their showcases or anything. But here it is. It's entitled The Stories Behind the Music. And this is Texas musical luminaries reveal the family histories, powerful influences, and big breaks that made them the artists they are today. And first profile, right after this. Over the course of several months, Texas Monthly worked with the South by Southwest Festival to put together a show called Texas Music, The Untold Stories, a singular event that would reveal the hidden narratives behind the careers of some of our state's most beloved artists. Seven Texas musicians, Austin singer-songwriter Sean Colvin, Fort Worth-raised songwriter-producer T-Bone Burnett, multi-hyphenate Houston performer Cam Franklin, Corpus Christi Nukumbia pioneer El Dusty, Houston rapper Lil Kiki, Rio Grande Valley roots artist Charlie Crockett, and San Antonio boogie-woogie pianist John Tennyson developed stories to share on stage at ACL Live at the movie theater on March, at the Moody Theater on March 17th, accompanied by Austin musician Carrie Rodriguez and her band. Unfortunately, just as this issue was going to print, we learned that the city of Austin, responding to the coronavirus outbreak, ordered South by Southwest to cancel the festival, meaning that Texas Music, The Untold Stories would not go on as planned. Though the live show was the heart of this project, we believe that these stories, which are by turns funny and serious but always frank, stand on their own. In the pages that follow, we've compiled a selection of the monologues as well as stories from Rodriguez and Austin musician Walker Lukens, who penned a special song based on a reader-submitted confession that he had planned to perform. Each of these stories illuminates a vital moment, conversation, or idea that animated an artist's aesthetic evolution. Together, they remind us why this current moment in Texas music is so exciting. Unabridged versions of these stories go to texasmonthly.com. And first up is Sean Colvin. Austin singer-songwriter remembers her early days in Texas and thinks ahead to her final days. He says, "I hang my hat in Austin and have for 26 years now. You don't count the 2 years I spent here in the mid-70s. Although I'm a transplant from the Midwest, I consider myself an Austinite, having done my part, I feel, to keep it weird. Here's how I begin my day. Rise at 6 a.m., feed the cat, take my meds, brush my teeth, make a beeline to Cafe Medici for my first cappuccino, flirt with the cute baristas who are young enough to be my children, drive past Whole Foods and Waterloo Records, across Lady Bird Lake, past the Green Mesquite, and on to Zilker Park and Barton Springs, also known as the Fountain of Youth. Swim a mile, swing by Juice Land to pick up a soul boulder, coconut water, banana, blue cherry, blueberry, cherry, almond, cacao powder, brown rice protein, coconut oil, vanilla, and cinnamon, and hold the brown rice protein, sub in peanut butter, and then I head home. At this point, the best part of my day is over, and the tortured songwriter must face the lonely guitar and the blank page. The very first time I came to Austin, it was 1976, and I was 20 years old. I left Southern Illinois and moved to Texas with a country swing band called the Dixie Diesels. We were sort of the asleep of the wheel of Carbondale, Illinois, and I was what people in that scene referred to as the girl singer. Truth is, I didn't really know from country music. I was raised on folk music like the Kingston Trio and Pete Seeger and Judy Collins. When the age of the singer-songwriter hit its peak in the early 70s, I was on board 100%. But I'd fallen in love with an Illinois fiddle player named Willie, so I joined his country band, and the rest is history. On our first night in Austin, Willie and I went to the Armadillo World headquarters, where we heard Rye Cooter and ate jalapeno-loaded nachos. Next day, we dined at the Stallion on 3-patty chicken-fried steak and had more jalapenos, and then took a dip in Barton Springs. That, let's see, make the jump here. And that evening, the Dixie Diesels played our first gig at the Split Rail, a dive with an asphalt floor where I consumed even more jalapenos and got drunk on Shiner Bock. I was falling in love with Austin, the way the light shone, the rich, fragrant, humid air, Town Lake, Matt's El Rancho, the always green live oaks, and the cast of musical characters that seemed to run the town. Put in mind of a scene in the movie Beetlejuice. After the families moved from New York City to suburban Connecticut, the daughter, an uber-goth teenager played by Winona Ryder, feels displaced and disoriented until she spots a gigantic black spider hanging in its web from her bedroom ceiling. She declares, "I could live here." I became an Austinite. I learned to two-step at the Broken Spoke and discovered Texas greats like Willis Allen Ramsey and Uncle Walt's band and Joe Ely. I fell in love with country music, singing and playing classics by Willie Nelson, Merle, Bob Wills, and Patsy. For the first time in my life, I felt like I'd found a place I could hang my hat, somewhere I might call home. But the Dixie Diesels broke up. Willie, fiddler, not that Willie, and I broke up too. I was 22, and I couldn't imagine settling down anywhere, ever. I just wanted to sing. In fact, that's all I knew how to do. There were plenty more dues to be paid, as it turned out. I knew that some way, somehow, I wanted to make a name for myself as a musical artist. I was dreaming big. 1978, 2 years after I'd gotten to Austin, I left town and eventually ended up in New York City, because if you can make it there, you know, and I did. 1987, I sang backup vocals on one of the biggest hits of the decade. Yes, that's me harmonizing behind Suzanne Vega on Luca, and a year later I got signed to Columbia Records. I was making albums and traveling the world and earning a decent living, and I began to think, well, hell, I can hang my hat anywhere I want now. I can choose a real home with a house, with a car and a driveway and a garden, own front door, cat or two, maybe even a kid. So I came back to Austin in 1994 for the light and the sky and the smell of the air and the live oaks and Rudy's BBQ and KGSR and Barton Springs, the fountain of youth. Ah, the fountain of youth. I just turned 64, so that ship has sailed. Having always been a wanderer at heart, I've been thinking about where I might live out my days, and in doing, I've had an epiphany. Home is not where you hang your hat. Home is where you scatter your ashes. Sure, I know I'll be dead and I won't care, but there's something about having the last say regarding the final destination of my bodily particles that's become a point of real concern, so much so that I've asked my Austin-born and bred daughter if she has an opinion about it, but my therapist told me it really needs to be my decision. I guess you could say this issue began to creep into my consciousness one perfect April afternoon several years back during a barbecue at my sister's place in South Austin. While our children frolicked in the pool and jumped on a trampoline in the backyard, while the men grilled burgers and dogs on the deck, while the women made pie and slaw in the kitchen, sports blared on the TV in the family room, I suddenly grew lightheaded and my stomach turned. I thought, oh God, no, it has happened. We are dug in. This was not the plan. What child of the 60s had fantasies of suburban bliss? Pleasant Valley Sunday, indeed. That moment of horror wore off, though. I took stock. I love my kid. I love my house. I love my nieces and my sister. And I love my town. I love my car. I love Threadgills. Rest in peace. Maybe being dug in wasn't so bad. It was certainly age appropriate. Following this train of thought to its conclusion, I landed on the ultimate bottom line. I will probably die here. And in that kitchen that afternoon, a song lyric came to me. It went, I'm gonna die in these four walls. Way to liven up a picnic, Sean. Today, my hat is hung. These four walls, my humble abode, my daughter's heart, my guitar, my car, the city limits of Austin, Texas. They all hold me. And in case you're curious, my ashes will be scattered in Barton Springs, the fountain of youth, just across the road from Chewy's in the dead of night, because it's probably illegal. That'll be our little secret. And so, next of our profiles here, we turn to El Dusty, the Corpus Christi DJ, producer, and new cumbia pioneer that spent his entire life surrounded by vinyl. My name is Horacio Oliveira, but you can call me El Dusty. When I was a kid growing up in Corpus Christi, we used to travel about an hour north to visit my uncle, Joe Henry Perez, in the town of Beeville. My uncle was a bit of an unusual guy. He was gay, and being gay in small-town Texas isn't the easiest thing in the world. Everyone knew he was gay, but it was mostly left unsaid. His family was really against it, so he never talked about it. Joe Henry was a well-liked art teacher, and he also collected albums. So many that he built a whole garage to store them in. He sourced these albums from his cousin, also named Joe, a local radio DJ known as La Voz de Oro, Golden Voice. They were best friends, grew up together, and loved a lot of the same music. I was still a kid when Joe Henry died, and after his passing, my family, my mom, my dad, my two brothers, and I inherited his LP collection. It was huge, like 3,000 albums. Everything from disco to Tejano to pop to Mexican ballads, it was all there. By that point, I was already a music fanatic. My parents had a big record collection. My mom had one of those music subscriptions that sent you records in the mail, so that she had a lot of records. My dad, who was a Vietnam vet, was into what I think of as Vietnam War era music. Funk, 70s rock, Chicano soul music. When I say he was into music, I mean he was really into it. When I was very small, he was involved in a motorcycle accident that left him paralyzed from the neck down. Sitting in a bed or wheelchair for 30 years, he built adventures in his mind. Then there's my older brother, who's about 8 years older than me. He was into gangster rap and 80s rock and heavy metal, soaking up all these different kinds of music. And there was cumbia. When I was in middle school, Selena, who also grew up in Corpus, was getting a lot of attention singing cumbia. But we heard lots of cumbia on the radio, at street festivals, at shows. So I'm just surrounded by all this music and vinyl, and I thought, hey, I'll be a DJ. Not a radio DJ like my uncle's cousin. I'd be a DJ with two turntables who plays at clubs and parties. I got my first turntables when I was 11. Not particularly proud of how I got them. Or maybe I am. My older brother and his gang pulled up in front of a quinceañera. They saw a trailer that was open, and they stole all the equipment. They gave me two Technique 1200s. DJ turntables around. I was the person in our family who fixed everything. I'm just good with machines. So DJing came to me pretty easy. I got good fast and was stitching together different kinds of music that people don't usually think of in the same breath. Hip-hop, Tejano, funk, Latin house. Because I was playing so many different kinds of music, when I started DJing, I brought hundreds of albums and 12-inch singles in crates, carrying them up and down stairs. It was a way different time before you could put hours of music on a flash drive or your laptop's hard drive and just mix from that. I know how to do a lot of things. Scratch, beat juggle, beat match by ear, that most people coming up today don't know how to do because I learned how to DJ straight from vinyl. I also played lots of sets on a local radio station, Z95. That was fun, but the real reason I did it was to get on the radio promo list. You got on that list, the record companies would send you free vinyl nearly every day. So I sent a fax with the radio station's letterhead at the top, and it worked. The albums and singles just started coming in. I was getting albums every day for years. The Fugees, Backstreet Boys, Cher. My mom was getting so pissed. Get them to stop sending stuff, she yelled at me. I didn't know how to make it stop or who to call. So I have all these albums from my uncle's collection, from my parents' collections, from my promo list collection. It's probably 15,000 albums. A friend did the math for me, and that's about 8,000 pounds of records, 4 tons of vinyl. And it's always weighed on me, and not just literally. I can't go anywhere without thinking about my collection. If I ever left Corpus, what would I do with it? In 2011, after I started making my own tunes and my career took off, I signed with Universal and I was going to LA every week. I thought about moving, but something kept me in Corpus. Maybe that something was my vinyl collection, because I like having the records around. And really, who's going to all 4 tons of records across the country? My mom passed away in 2013, and my dad died 4 years later. But our massive collection still lives in a room of its own at their house. When I go back and listen to some of those old records, I think of my mom, who was always dancing and singing. She was a little girl at heart. I think of my dad sitting in his wheelchair, listening to his music, letting it take him places his body couldn't go. Those records are my way of traveling back in time. I always assumed that after my parents passed, I'd finally move to LA, but that's not how it turned out. 2017, I bought an old property in Corpus's crumbling downtown. I started a company called Produce, and we make cool stuff that shows where we come from, like made in Corpus flags and a cumbia hat. I live on the building's second floor, but downstairs I set up an art studio and a wine bar, and we're building a recording studio. I'm trying to create something in my city, something that Selena would have been proud of, something my parents would have been proud of. And I'm building a special place for my family's music collection. I was inspired by my uncle's garage in Belleville, the one where he stored all his beloved vinyl that's now mine. I'm constructing shelving that's 18 feet wide and 11 feet high. There'll be one of those ladders that's attached to a runner that'll let you get to the records way up high. It's all the music that has made me what I am. It means everything to me, and I want to have it with me always. And the next profile here is a little peaky, but this is a good stop here to make a point, remind you, listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on sight and to sound broadcasting. This year marked over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and to Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and to Sound Radio since 1967. Now, we turn into our next profile here from the music that did not get heard this year at the South and Southwest. I'm a little disappointed myself. This is a little Kiki. Houston is a driving city. It's only fitting that one of the city's most celebrated rappers started his musical career in a car. In Houston, we like old school big bodies, Cadillacs, Lincolns, Oldsmobiles, with bright candy paint, big rims, known as swangins. We call these cars slabs. Just like our music, our car culture was born in the streets of Houston in the early 80s. Ever since, the two art forms have been inseparable. As a trendsetter of Houston hip hop, it's only appropriate that I began my musical career in a car. This car wasn't a slab, though. It was a hoopty, shorthand for a everyday car with tinted windows. In this case, a burgundy 1979 Chevrolet Monte Carlo. When I was 15, I bought my hoopty for $200 from a guy who lived around the corner from my house. The car didn't have a motor, so one of my friends stole another car. And Uncle Bebe, my neighbor, installed the stolen motor for me. My friends and I would roll around the South Side, and because the car didn't have a radio, played tapes on handheld dual cassette radios and freestyled over them. Started getting better and better, and before I knew it, I was one of the top freestylers in the neighborhood. We're also on the way to starting our own group on the block, the Herschel Wood Hardheads. By 1991 or 1992, my barber, Steve, used to cut designs like Ninja Turtles in my hair and begun cutting DJ Screw's hair. Back then, Screw was starting to get famous for his signature slowed down tracks that later became known as Chopped and Screwed. He was still a mixtape DJ, and you'd pay him $10 for a mixtape of slowed down songs, and you could record your own freestyle at the end. These tapes had begun floating around our neighborhood. Instead of listening to the radio, we could listen to people we actually knew. That was huge. I was obsessed with the idea of getting on one of these tapes, so I convinced Steve to take me to DJ Screw's house. Not every 15-year-old kid was bold enough to show up at Screw's house, but I've always been relentless. Growing up, I didn't have a lot. If I wanted something, I had to get it myself. My mother was a housekeeper. My father loved me, but he was 50 when I was born and couldn't relate to my life. By the time I was 14, I was skipping school and hustling in the streets. But I was self-reliant. Whatever clothes I had, whatever food I had in my belly, it came from me.
I worked at Taco Bell, McDonald's, and Kroger. I wasn't going to school wearing old shoes. My adolescent life unfolded during the worst parts of the crack era. Users were stealing from their own houses, and dealers were engaging in violence. We were living so fast that the trauma we were inflicting on our community didn't register. Despite the challenges, I was lucky. I was always smart and blessed with the gift of gab. I'd be in the lunchroom freestyling and have the whole place packed. Even back then, as a teenager, I was very crafty with my first lines. My first time at Screw's house was no different. I said something about little Kiki rolling foreign. That line might sound ordinary today, but back then it was different. Suddenly, everybody in the neighborhood was talking about that one line, so much so that Screw agreed to let me come back and make my own tape. Next time I went to Screw's house, I got on the mic and wrecked it. Screw didn't understand how long I'd been practicing. He was so impressed, he started spreading the word to everyone who walked in his door. One day, me and my friends are chilling on the block, and a big white Cadillac with swangers pulls up. Driver rolls down his window and asks for Lil Kiki. We were so bad back then, stealing rims and cars and everything, we thought we might be in trouble. Everyone was looking at me like, man, Kiki, what you done this time? The man behind the wheel said, man, you the one been rapping on those tapes? I said, yeah. And he said, I got a tape I'm going to make. I want you to come and rap on it. Come on. After a while, people in nice cars started coming around looking for me. I was only 16 or 17 at the time. One day, I'm at Screw's house, and I hear a knock on the door, and in walks Fat Pat. Pat was something of a myth. I'd never heard any of his music, but the rumor was that he'd won a big local freestyle competition. People already called him the Freestyle King. My neighborhood wouldn't let me forget that fact. When Pat walked in the door, I'm shook. It's actually him. I'm thinking, it's Fat Pat. First thing Screw says is, Pat, this is a little homie I've been telling you about right here. Lil Kiki. Pat is like, turn it on. Let's do one right now. I was naturally nervous. Screw turns on the beat. Pat freestyles 4 or 5 lines. Then he just starts singing. I got it on my mind. Lil Duke, another local artist, did a few lines of freestyle. Pat sang the hook again. And then I finished the song with my freestyle. Screw is like, wow, this is an actual song. It was the first song me and Pat ever did together. And it was the beginning of the Lil Kiki and Fat Pat era. Pretty soon, everyone was knocking on his door saying, I want Pat and Key. From there, the legend of DJ Screw and the rap collective I became part of, Screwed Up Click, began to grow. Eventually, around 1996, Screw was working on his iconic album, 3 in the Morning Part 2. I asked him about getting on the album every single day. I knew this was going to be my first chance to get on a Screw tape that would be in a store. You'd be able to go into Soundwaves and buy it. Then one day, Screw beeps me. I had a beeper at the time, and he's like, I'm over at Maestro's recording. I want you to come do a verse for 3 in the morning. Whenever I was with Screw, I'd be freestyling, and he'd be mixing and scratching up all these records, and then without warning, he'd just hand me that mic. He did the same thing for 3 in the morning. The song was playing in the studio, and Screw starts pointing to me. He thought I was going to do a freestyle, but I had something else planned. I didn't hesitate. I'm draped up and dripping out. Know what I'm talking about. 3 in the morning, getting the gat out, the stash pop spot. I did the verse in one take. It wasn't a freestyle. It was a rap that I'd written in my head. That song ended up being the lead single off 3 in the Morning and the first chopped and slowed song that ever went on the radio. It took on a life of its own. And now, some 20-odd years later, Drake has used my draped up and dripped out line on his big mixtape, So Far Gone, and Beyonce has performed the Southside dance I made famous in the song of the same name. Because of all that, I can provide for my family. But my impact is bigger than my loved ones or even my block. I become a mentor and a community activist whose volunteer work was honored by Barack Obama. My fortune, my influence, and my story is connected to that moment with Screw at Maestro Studio. That's when I became a Texas legend. And next up here is a little short one here. This is Kerry Rodriguez, classically trained violinist, grew up in Austin with dreams of playing in a symphony. She abandoned them after an encounter with Lyle Lovett. She says, I never planned on being a fiddler. My goal was to get into a symphony orchestra and teach violin lessons on the side. I had the privilege of studying with a wonderful teacher, Bill Dick. I started a pilot program teaching Suzuki violin lessons to kindergartners the same year I started. When I heard those squawking violins down the hall at Cassis Elementary School, I knew I had to join them. 12 years of lessons and many sore fingers later, I was accepted to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music on a full-ride scholarship in 1996. All of this seemed to point me toward a career in classical music, but instead of working on scales, I found myself listening to Texas country icons like Towns Van Zandt with Cinda Williams for hours on a stereo in my musty dorm room. All I wanted to do was fiddle along with her albums. Growing up with a Texas singer-songwriter father, I often took this music for granted. Moving across the country made me realize how remarkable Texas music was. Around that time, Lyle Lovett, a family friend, asked me to come to a show he was playing nearby in Cleveland, Ohio, and to bring my violin to a sound check. He never heard me play, but I think he was genuinely curious. I showed up, palms sweating, and his large band asked me to sit in on the fastest song in their repertoire. That's right, you're not from Texas. Then came time for my solo, and I had zero groove and was probably playing in the wrong key. I didn't know how to improvise over a swing tune and was mortified. They were gracious about it, but they sure didn't invite me to sit in at the gig. Later that night, I watched in awe as Lyle's fiddler at the time, Andrea Zahn, and the band played. At that moment, I knew I wanted to accompany an elevated song. I wanted to play Texas music. I had no idea that would lead me to where I am now, but I'm grateful for every twist and turn. Even the ones that embarrassed the hell out of me. All right. Next up, another one of these musical profiles, Charlie Crockett. Now, two trailblazing country musicians from San Benito led parallel lives decades apart. Born in 1984 in the old Dolly Vincent Memorial Hospital in San Benito. Me, my mama, and my grandmother lived several miles away from there outside of Los Fresnos in a trailer on Old Port Road, Route 3, Box 87 was our address. Our trailer was parked on the edge of Resaca, where we were surrounded by grapefruit orchards and sugarcane, big agave plants and mesquite trees. My mama did the weather on KBEO, a TV station out of Brownsville. She would sing Billie Holiday and ZZ Top around the house, and I'd sing along with her. That's when I first started to get into music. What I remember most about San Benito, though, is Freddie Fender. Freddie was born there in the 30s, and even after he became a big country star, he always came back to play concert. He was the local hero when I was coming up, the pride of the Rio Grande Valley. He was everywhere. Some of my earliest musical memories are watching Freddie perform on the Johnny Canales Show, a talent show that focused on South Texas music like Tejano Conjunto. Selena sang on it when she was 13. I loved Johnny Canales. He was so magnetic. They shot the show in the same studio where my mama worked, so she took me to see it a few times. I loved the variety show aspect, the costumes, and the people that Johnny brought on. At home, I'd stand on a milk crate and pretend to be him. Whenever Freddie appeared on Johnny's show, he wore the flashiest suits, and he had the biggest hair. He also had the sweetest voice and was really a positive presence. I'd see his tapes and albums with those amazing covers, like the back of Before the Next Teardrop Falls, which has a picture of him with his leg hunched way up. I remember seeing footage of him and Dolly Parton singing the title track, and they were so cool together. Wasted Days and Wasted Nights was one of his biggest hits. I can remember being in the trailer and hearing that song. I didn't realize it then, but I wound up doing a lot of things that Freddie had done before me. Like, we both used stage names. Freddie was born Baldomar Garza Huerta and came up with Freddie Fender. The surname is taken from the guitar brand because he knew it would help him sell records to, as he put it, gringos. I was born Matthew Charles Crockett, but I started going by Charlie 15 years ago because my grandfather's name was Charlie Crockett and because, well, Matthew, I knew that wasn't going to pop. Freddie and I also came up with alter egos. Called himself El Bebop Kid when he started playing rock and roll in the late 50s, and I go by Lil GL when I do my more traditional country and blues songs. We also both got busted for weed. The difference is, it was so much harder in his time. He served 3 years in Angola prison in Louisiana for a couple of joints. I had a lot more on me than that. 1963, he was set free early by Louisiana Governor Jimmy Davis, himself a singer who loved the way Freddie sang. Me, I pleaded with my judge. I got busted in Virginia shortly before I was going to perform at the Granada in Dallas, my first headlining show at a theater with a band. I sent the judge my first two CDs and begged him to let me do unsupervised probation, and he said yes. Music saved Freddie and me. We also both spent about 5 years in New Orleans learning our chops. He went there in the 60s after he got out of prison. He worked as a busboy and would sit in with singers like Art Neville at all those little clubs in the French Quarter. It's where Freddie picked up a lot of his R&B feel. I spent some time in New Orleans, too, learning all about American music, early country, jazz, and blues. Like a lot of people from my generation, I was a hip-hop kid. That's what influenced me. That's where I learned meter and how to improvise. Around 2006, I was traveling around the country, and I wound up in New Orleans performing with hip-hop dudes on street corners. At that time, after Katrina, there were so many young musicians in New Orleans. I'd see kids playing Appalachian music on banjos, young women playing fiddle tunes, and gospel bands covering Just a Closer Walk with Thee. I discovered classic songs like All of Me and started forming bands, brass bands, bands including a guy with a snare and a bass drum, mixed up bands, whoever was around. I learned how to swing in New Orleans. If you listen to banjo music from Tennessee, early blues from Texas, early traditional music from Louisiana, you'll hear that they play downstrokes on the first and third beat of each measure. New Orleans taught me to swing that old traditional beat. It's not difficult, it's just a paradigm shift, playing on the two and the four instead of the one and the three. I was learning what American music is built on. You can hear that on A Stolen Jewel, my first album. It's country music, but it's blues, it's soul, it's Louisiana, it's Texas. I found my voice singing my kind of country music, just like Freddie Fender did. Music from South Texas is country as hell. The murder ballads, the revolutionary border music, story songs. There's nothing pure about it. It takes in influences from all over. Freddie spent his career singing not just country, but conjunto, rock and roll, and R&B. When this middle-aged Hispanic dude with a huge afro took Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, a mashup of country music and swamp pop from Louisiana and Southeast Texas, to number one on the country charts, it shouldn't have been a surprise. I covered Wasted Days on my second record, In the Night. I changed it some. Freddie played it in a major key E, and I took it to a D-flat minor and sped it up. He's doing a waltz. I did a 4-4 beat, and it changed the melody a little. When I sing Freddie's song, I feel the damp energy of Texas nights, playing in smoky bars in Port Arthur, bars on Greenville and Dallas. It's such a visual song. Even when I was a kid, it was so powerful. Who doesn't have wasted days and wasted nights in their lives? Getting messed up, hurt by love, going nowhere with your life. Freddie doesn't get much credit for his music, but I think he's as much an innovator as Chuck Berry, with his rhythms and records crossing so many genres. One place Freddie does get respect is in San Benito, where his face is on the city water tower. After I put out my sixth album, The Valley, last year, people down there started saying they should put my face on the water tower, too. I haven't earned it yet, but I'm not ready to get up there with Freddie. But I'll tell them, if you do put me up there one day, keep Freddie on the front side facing the highway. Put me on the back where I can look out over the orchards and the sugar cane. And let's see, got a couple more here. We got Walker Lukens, the Austin musician, often writes songs based on listener-submitted confessions. This is what he'd own up to. In 2006, the summer after my freshman year at college, I went on a road trip with three friends to Canada. Thought I'd be home in time for my sister's engagement party in Houston, but I got the dates wrong. So I called my parents and told them I couldn't make it by car. I'd have to fly from Los Angeles. Will you buy me a flight? I asked. They were angry, but agreed. When my friends and I rolled into L.A., we got drunk, and then they took me to the airport. I got through security, sat by my gate, and fell asleep, and missed my flight. I managed to get on a later flight. When I arrived, my parents wouldn't even look at me. It took a long time to gain their trust again. My sister, on the other hand, thought the whole thing was hilarious. Next profile here, John Tennyson. The San Antonio boogie-woogie pianist and historian traced the genre's roots to a small East Texas town that had no idea of its own legacy. You You probably heard of Boogie Woogie. Its distinctive bass riffs pop up in Led Belly's guitar playing, Elvis Presley's version of Otis Blackwell's All Shook Up, and Stevie Ray Vaughan's Rude Mood. You can hear its strong influence in the music of pop and jazz pianists such as Jerry Lee Lewis, Fats Domino, and Oscar Peterson. "Everything I play is boogie woogie," Little Richard once said. "Rock and roll is just up-tempo boogie woogie." What you may not know is that Boogie Woogie was born right here in the Lone Star State, specifically in the East Texas drinking and dancing establishments known as barrel houses. After years of research, I believe I've zeroed in on the town where Boogie Woogie was first played in the early 1870s, or at least the town at the center of the area where Boogie Woogie was first played. It's not like people were keeping official records about that sort of thing 150 years ago. That town is Marshall, the seat of Harrison County, which sits snug up against the Louisiana border. It's impossible to say with absolute certainty that the big breakthrough happened within Marshall city limits, but it's almost certainly happened in the vicinity of the town. I felt confident enough that in 2010 I told Marshall's civic leaders that their city should be designated the birthplace of Boogie Woogie. Now, there's one thing you have to understand about Marshall. It wasn't the most progressive city in terms of race. Harrison County had the largest population of enslaved people of any county in Texas at the outset of the Civil War, and during the first two decades of the 20th century, it was the site of at least a dozen lynchings. Throughout much of the 20th century, the city was split largely along racial lines, but it was also the site of some of the earliest and most successful civil rights struggles in Texas. James Farmer, one of the most important national civil rights leaders in the 60s, was born and raised in Marshall. So the city leaders weren't exactly shocked when I told them about a man named Dave Alexander Elam, a world-famous boogie-woogie player who'd grown up in Marshall and, appalled by the racism he experienced there, left town in 1957, swearing never to return. Elam moved to Oakland, California, and played and recorded with everyone from Muddy Waters to Buddy Guy, released albums as Dave Alexander, wrote articles for Living Blues magazine, and converted to Islam, changing his name to Omar Sharif. How highly regarded was he? In 1977, Contemporary Keyboard Magazine ranked him second greatest living blues pianist in the world. The first was Ray Charles. Most people in Marshall had never heard of Omar Sharif, but when I told the city leaders that he was the most important living link in Marshall's boogie-woogie heritage, they asked me to invite him back for a homecoming concert. So I headed out to California. When I found Omar, who was then living in Sacramento, he was teetering on the edge of homelessness. His only regular music gig dried up a few weeks earlier, and he couldn't pay his bills. He suffered from multiple ailments, including opioid and alcohol addiction, as well as chronic leg pain caused by vein harvesting that had been conducted for his coronary artery bypass. He was at risk of being evicted from his apartment. Even so, Omar gave me a private performance in his apartment on a dilapidated Kurzweil digital piano with broken keys. As he played, a bottle of prescription medication bounced around on top of the keyboard. I was stunned. Despite Omar's physical issues, the music, covers of Patchman Farm, I'm Your Hoochie Coochie Man, What I Say, and Misty poured out of him. When he was done, I asked if he was willing to go back to the place he'd swore he'd never return to. It took some time to get him to believe that the town that had made his early life so difficult now wanted to honor him, but eventually he realized that I was on the level. Omar Sharif returned to Marshall for a homecoming concert. It took place on June 11, 2010 at the Visual Arts Center. The audience of more than 400 people was decidedly integrated, a rare occurrence in Marshall, even in the 21st century. Classmates from Omar's alma mater, Pemberton High School, were there, as were city leaders. He was enthusiastically introduced by the concert's producer, Jack Campson, a screenwriter and publicist who'd been a student at the all-white Marshall Junior High School in 1955 when Omar first left to join the Navy. There was an air of apprehension as Omar took the stage. Could this elderly man, clearly frail, live up to the billing he'd been given? Omar began by playing solo on a Steinway Grand that had been brought in from Shreveport for the concert. He started with a composition of his own, Fingers of Fire, then built a case for the importance of Boogie Woogie and the origins of rock and roll by drawing connections between tunes such as Cow Cow Boogie and Whole Lot of Shaking Going On. His lucid playing and his expert commentary between songs made the link between the two genres crystal clear. Omar was then joined by a trio of local backup musicians, and you could feel the audience's collective pulse start to quicken. One of the concert's sponsors was a notoriously straight-laced man who was known to avoid gatherings where alcohol was served and dancing was encouraged. When Omar began singing a song called It's the Booty, Not the Beauty, many heads turned to see how this gentleman would react, and everyone was surprised to see him and his wife all smiles, clapping their hands and tapping their feet. When the concert ended, the entire crowd stood up for a rousing ovation, and Omar had tears in his eyes. 8 months later, Omar left California and settled in Marshall for good. The city named him an artist in residence and provided him rent-free apartment with all utilities paid. Played shows weekly at a local pub. The kindness the town was belatedly showing him seemed to have gone a long way toward healing old wounds. Sadly, Omar's medical problems never let up. He was still addicted to opioids and alcohol, and his legs still hurt him terribly. On January 8, 2012, Omar Sharif took his life. He was 73 years old. Omar's memorial is much love, so much admiration, everywhere he went. Several area musicians performed The Golden Time of Life, The Sky is Crying, and two of Omar's originals, The Raven and House Built by the Blues. For the close of the service, I joined in on a boogie-woogie jam. Today, Marshall boasts a Texas historical marker, declaring it the birthplace of boogie-woogie, which I regard as the most influential musical genre to ever come out of Texas. The town is also the resting place of Omar Sharif. The headstone that sits atop his grave in Algoma Cemetery will allow current and future pilgrims to pay their respects to a great American artist whose life speaks volumes about the story of our country, about the indignities of racism, the joyous art that black men and women create in the face of persecution, and the role that music can play in the work still unfinished that we're doing to repair so much of our past. And we go now to our last profile. It's Cam Franklin. Front woman of Houston's The Suffers, has a successful career in the oil and gas industry, but when she got an offer to play a late-night talk show, she quit her job. In October 2014, my band, The Suffers, played CMJ Music Marathon in the southwest of New York City. We did 6 or 7 showcases that week, and at the last one, this guy walked up to me before the show and said, "I work for David Letterman." I was like, that's not a kind thing to lie about. Then I thought, wait, what if he's telling the truth? The guy was gone when we got off stage, but a month later we got a call from his office asking to speak to our publicist. We didn't have a publicist yet. Back then I worked as a gas and power trade support analyst at the Houston office of an Australian global financial services company. My job involved checking the gas and power deal tickets. Everyone regarded it as tedious work, but I was really good at it. Since I had pretty much convinced myself that music wasn't going to happen, I committed to making that my career. And then Letterman came calling and I changed my mind. On my last day of work in January 2015, my colleagues got me a really big card and filled it with cash. They knew how hard making it into music was going to be. Follow your dreams, they wrote. Don't come back here. Everyone else in the band quit their jobs too. How did it work out? Well, we're working on our third album right now, and I haven't checked a gas and power deal ticket in a long, long time. That very conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening. Texas, a monthly magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight and Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
All Ector County Senior Centers are closed to the public until further notice. The Northside Senior Center will serve lunch and carry out trays for seniors 60 and older. Call in advance by 9 a.m. at 432-337-5281. Again, that number is 337-5281. Pickup times will be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the center, 1225 Adams Avenue.
Weekdays during the 6 a.m. hour, we present several programs on business, money, and investing. Mondays, it's the Kiplinger Letter and Money Matters. Tuesday, The Economist. Wednesday, the Houston Business Journal. Thursdays, Down to Business. And Fridays, the Local Business and Oil Report. Weekdays beginning at 6 a.m. And remember, we bring you daily business news at 6 p.m. from the Wall Street Journal on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time, I'll get along. You'll find another, and I'll be here if you should find you ever need me. Don't say a word about tomorrow or forever. There'll be time enough for sadness when you leave me. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 77 and partly cloudy and windy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg, While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark, revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas, with more than 7,000 azalea bushes along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize Garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare Hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas, native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower-growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April, you should be able to enjoy the beauty of these gardens. If you come later, you may see many of the Satsuki varieties, which bloom in late April and into early June, depending on the variety, and the popular Encore series and other reblooming azaleas that produce a second wave of colorful blooms later in the year. The Disappeared Man Who Loved Azaleas by William Shike. The luxurious blooms of Hoying Azalea hybrids hide a sad story about their corrector, T. Lin Hoying. This historically obscure man lived in China, where he bred numerous varieties of his beloved plant.